Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The newly independent Dutch Republic established a vast and profitable trade network in the 17th century. Among the most coveted of the impressive luxury imports was the parrot. Beautiful, exotic, and rare, parrots became a mainstay in Dutch genre paintings. Their presence in these works, however, is more than ostentatious display. These very social and intelligent creatures were highly valued companions. The interaction between parrots and people gave Dutch genre painters an unprecedented opportunity for creativity and candor, upon which they skillfully capitalized. In this lecture, held on December 26 at the National Gallery of Art, Kristen Gonzalez traces the iconography of these birds in the history of art and highlights the departure from tradition evident in their depiction in the Dutch Golden Age. This lecture accompanies the landmark exhibition Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry, on view from October 22, 2017 through January 21, 2018, which examines the artistic exchanges among Johannes Vermeer and his contemporaries from the mid-1650s to around 1680, when they reached the height of their technical ability and mastery of genre painting.
Welcome. My name is Kristen Gonzalez, and I am delighted to be here on behalf of the Department of Northern Baroque Paintings at the National Gallery of Art. I think it is safe to assume many of you have overindulged in the last few days. And before we make a noble attempt at New Year's resolutions, I invite you to step into a world in which conspicuous consumption, as so exquisitely illustrated in the works of Dutch genre paintings, will further indulge your senses. Today, I'm going to talk to you about the parrot, a very conspicuous presence in 17th century Dutch paintings. I think we'd be very hard-pressed to conjure a more suitable mascot than the vibrant, exotic, intelligent parrot to convey the pride of the Dutch in the Golden Age. Following the Treaty of Munster in 1648, Spanish embargoes were lifted, the Dutch colonies overseas were recognized, and this meant more opportunity to export exotic species of parrots into the ports of Amsterdam. The vast global network of the Dutch trading companies provided access to rare and beautiful things, including many species of parrots, which were highly coveted and gifted by diplomats to various dignitaries or sold to wealthy citizens. The demand for display of their trade prowess and resulting affluence was high, and the spoils of such prosperous commerce, including porcelain from China, exquisite textiles and foodstuffs from Turkey and the Far East, were enthusiastically incorporated onto panel and canvas. But if a cult of personality was necessary to herald the glory of the Golden Age, the parrot fit the bill. The freedom from Spanish oppression not only circumvented the near monopoly they held on parrots and other imports, the freedom from ideology meant Dutch artists were really able to spread their wings, so to speak. Academic allegories illustrating biblical and mythological content, as these two featured here, evolved into innovative, modern, secular subject matter. These compositions underscore the fundamental beliefs and ideals of this nation, utilizing an entirely new pictorial vocabulary. Still lifes, landscapes, portraits, and paintings of domestic interiors, to name a few compositional types, were masterfully rendered and appreciated not only for their aesthetic quality, but for the rich subtlety of their message. Often these works and motifs within them are ripe with ambiguity, inviting the viewer to contemplate philosophical issues such as vanitas, the fleeting nature of life, guised in beautiful but deceptively simple motifs. We return to works by Dutch masters time and time again. In the 20th century, with enthusiasm that is unprecedented in the history of museum exhibitions and unfettered even by the federal government's shutdown and Mother Nature's wintry exhibition of her own talent. And in this century, by less notoriety, fortunately, as we are all here today, but a deeper, richer exploration of Dutch genre painting, with the perspective of contemporary painters other than Jan Vermeer, Gerhard Terborch, Gabriel Metsu, Frans van Mieris, to name a few, who who have been the subject of monographic exhibitions here following 1995 and preceding the current show. And this is an image of our beloved curator, Arthur Wheelock, with one of our many esteemed special guests, a collector of small microscopes produced in the 17th century, one in particular, which was of interest to us given Vermeer's geographer and astronomer. What is it that we are seeking in returning to these works? Aesthetic enjoyment of exponential proportions? Yes, but I'm somewhat biased. The impossible challenge to pronounce definitive intent on behalf of the artist, to decipher an endless array of motifs, these iconographic riddles, if they had such purpose. Or are we seeking to find something of ourselves in these works, something that resonates with our contemporary experience, or an experience of our own, personal and private, like the ones we are privileged enough to witness in Vermeer's Young Woman Before a Mirror, from the Gemäldegalerie in Berlin, in which this young woman gazes into her reflection in the mirror, so absorbed in her thoughts, so universal in the moment in which she catches sight of herself, yet so far removed by virtue of the fact that we cannot begin to read her mind. I believe we return to these works for a number of reasons. The aesthetic value is, in my opinion, unparalleled in the work of Franz von Meer's depiction of a woman with a parrot. This painting is about this small, and von Meer's talent as a Feenschilder painter is stunning in its detailed, layered application of paint to panel, presenting to the lucky viewer an awe-inspiring, breathtaking jewel of artistry. At the same time, this work is infinitely complex, and I believe often misunderstood. This is a very intimate moment. What do we make of it? This is where the third element comes in. Something of this interaction between this woman and this animal, which resonates with our own experience in a private moment, seemingly unaware of the presence of others. Her thoughts, like those of Vermeer's Woman Before the Mirror, are completely her own. We will never know, but the presence of the parrot in this work by von Meer may be able to tell us infinitely more, especially if we differentiate the parrot from the many devices incorporated into works of this period. Importantly, however, the parrot is not a device. It's not simply a motif. These painted interiors present a dichotomy which is vexing. We have exclusive access into this world. But in so many ways, we are denied access into the personal thoughts and feelings of the figures so strikingly realized on canvas and panel. There is an intensity to these figures which draws us in, leaves us perplexed, and often overly reliant upon iconography, the clue which may provide us with insight. Often, as with the case of Johannes Vermeer, these clues are not there. As Arthur Wheelock has often and accurately observed, the stark simplicity of many Vermeer's works, as evident in the vast expanse of the white wall behind the figure of the woman, leave very little for iconographic inquiry. With the exception of Vermeer, parrots are everywhere in Dutch paintings, especially genre paintings. If you do not see one, you will see its cage. If you can find neither, you are either not looking hard enough, or there may be, I believe, a deliberate reason for its exclusion. Elegantly attired women tend to noble pursuits such as sewing in the company of these exotic birds, as we see here with the von Meer's on the left. The family portrait often includes the parrot, and as illustrated here by Slingeland on the right, its position in the center of the composition and the center of the family is noteworthy. The Dutch spend their leisure time in a number of ways, drinking, making music, often together, and frequently including the parrot in such compositions. Sometimes it is the more raucous environment of the Jan Steen party taking place here, in which the adults imbibe and make merry before the children, ensuring that each and every one of their bad habits is learned. And to cement this, a self-portrait of Steen himself instructs this young boy here in the corner how to smoke a pipe, all under the watchful eye of the parrot in the corner, the witness of such debauchery. Other times, it's a courtship ritual unfolding before us, in which the parrot plays an important role, as if this work by by de Hoogh on the left, which I will discuss shortly. Still other examples illustrate the sumptuous interiors of the most elegant citizens, in which even the most refined are infused with suggestive romance by means of harmonious duets, significant décolleté, and the presence of the uncaged bird. In my humble opinion, the intimate nature, small-scale personality, and intelligence of the parrot could find no better pictorial expression than in the canvas and paintings of the 17th century Northern Netherlands. Today I will examine the iconography of the parrot, particularly in the latter half of the 17th century. And by that, I mean the tradition of scholarship, which has offered a distinct interpretation of the parrot and its cage. I propose an interpretation which is not alternative, but additive in nature, but one which also stems from a vastly different, some might say, unconventional methodology. I'd like to think this approach is, however, practical and innovative, just as the Dutch would have wanted. First, I will discuss the parrot's role as companion to the wealthy elite featured in these works, and how such companionship renders the parrot much more than status symbol. Second, I will explore the literary and pictorial tradition, which inextricably links the parrot and the cage. The result is often that the parrot without the cage renders a very specific meaning, as does the cage without the parrot. This connection not only dates back centuries, but it is universal in its metaphorical application. It is consistently moralizing. Third, and referenced in the title of today's lecture, I will address the concept of imitatio, the parrot's ability to speak in a manner which is purely imitative, an assumption which has restricted the scope of analysis through which we view these works so prominently featuring the animal. 21st century neuroscience has compared the cognitive abilities of some species of parrots to that of a 4 or 5 year old child, and ranked the intelligence of these parrots as comparable, in some respects, superior to dolphins and chimpanzees. I believe, in the case of some of these works, the receptive, scientifically advanced, and innovative manner of Dutch thinking may have also recognized the intelligence of some of these parrot species, an intelligence which extends well beyond mimicry. Those of you here today may not initially make such associations upon looking at this very popular wall of parrots in the exhibition. We can perhaps understand their popularity as pets for their vibrant plumage and speaking abilities, and you don't need to take them for walks. What is remarkable about this grouping of works is really at the heart of this lecture today. Three women of considerable wealth and status are featured in works painted in Leiden in the Northern Netherlands in the 1660s. One leans out of the architectural artifice of the window niche, her attention focused elsewhere. One looks directly at us, and one is simply, seemingly, completely unaware of our existence. Other juxtapositions in the show, such as these two women writing, evoke similar responses by way of their interaction with the viewer. On the left, Gerard Terborch's model and half-sister Hesina focuses intensely upon her composition, perhaps a letter, a poem we cannot say with certainty. Vermeer's model seems to stop mid-sentence or mid-stanza, her quill in hand as if we have just walked into her space, and looks directly at the viewer, a slight smile playing upon her lips. These three women's engagement, whether it is with the viewer, the task at hand, or distraction, is noteworthy in comparison. In the case of the Terborch and the Vermeer, the compositional similarities are striking, but thematically, the motif of a woman writing is not highly informative. When appreciated as more than a motif, however, parrots and paintings inform us, and in some cases, provide an unprecedented opportunity to understand Dutch culture in the Golden Age, their norms, their expectations, and in some cases, the private thoughts of an individual captured by the brush. In the center is the work of Caspar Netscher, a painting which will forever hold a very special place in my heart. I came to the National Gallery in August of 2016 as this acquisition was made. Walking into the conservation lab with Arthur, I felt very much like the young research intern working for him in the summer of 1999, apprehensive, unsure of my new role in this esteemed department at the National Gallery. This painting was out of its frame, propped safely against the wall on a table for examination. I knew without a doubt my new role was meant to be, as the parrot featured in this work is also in my personal collection, the African Grey. The parrot in Caspar Netscher's painting is very much a symbol of status. I cannot dismiss the obvious association between the bird and the very privileged society in which this young woman lived. While this work may appear on the surface simply another painting of a wealthy, attractive woman holding a pretty bird, the tradition from which it derived reveals much, much more. History reveals so much more. Important figures, for reasons personal or political, desired to own an animal which they believed would define them as individuals or project a set of ideals which they were unable to convey on their own. After all, Alexander the Great did not have a Twitter account. So he lent his name proudly to this Indian import, the Alexandrian parakeet, to highlight his successful conquests in the East. Macrobius records Octavian's triumphal adventus following his victory over Mark Antony at the Battle of Actium, where a raven originally greeted him, "Hail Caesar, victor and conqueror." But a lucrative man offered him a parrot who addressed him in the same manner, which the young emperor immediately took home. Augustus later learned with dismay that parrots, ravens, and magpies had been trained to greet his former adversary with "Hail, Antony!" in the event that he was unsuccessful in battle. Nonetheless, the parrot flattered him and provided him with affirmation of his new imperial title. Charlemagne and Pope Martin V were parrot owners as well. The latter even appointed a keeper of parrots at the Vatican and lodged these prize parrots in the Camera de Papagayo. And while his reign comes well after the 17th century, the beloved Winston Churchill is featured in this photograph with his beloved cockatoo. I illustrate these not only for your entertainment, but to underscore the fact that the parrot's value is not only in its beauty, but as a creature which is exotic, clever, and eloquent. Therefore, the parrot does have a significant and unique value as a symbol, as it underscores the same characteristics in its owner, linking an owner or an individual with specific desirable traits, whether the utterance was hundreds of thousands living under Alexander the Great, or a select few, as in the case of the wealthy elite who had the opportunity to view these works. The employment of the parrot in literature and the visual arts was, in this sense, highly effective. Visually, we appreciate the beauty of the woman in the Caspar Netscher, her dress. But the parrot and the Turkish rug draped over the ledge of the niche indicate her educated, rarefied background, privileged and savvy enough to covet such exotic imports. So undoubtedly, a symbol of wealth, erudition, worldliness. In these paintings, however, I observe something fascinating and entirely without precedent in the history of art. Depicted in the private quarters of domestic interiors, as with the Franz von Mieris on the far right, and even in the artificial construct of the niche in the Kirak Dao on the left, the parrot has pride of place, so to speak. 17th century Dutch genre paintings allow us a window into their world, even if it is slightly altered for our voyeurism. In the case of Netscher's painting, a young boy emerges from the shadows bearing a small plate, probably of pewter, in his hands. Here is where my experience as a parrot owner came in handy. The running joke among bird nerds such as myself is that dogs have owners, parrots have staff. It took a little while to convince my own department here to see what was taking place in this work. Yes, the young boy is serving the parrot, as you can see. Their eyes are directly locked, and it's possible and likely that this young boy had some trepidation as he bears what appears to be this biscuits on the platter. In a later painting by Netscher's contemporary, Pieter de Hoch, the page boy enters the scene with a platter full of vibrant oranges, again intended for the parrot. These birds are members of the family, spoiled enough to warrant such attention and service. This begs the question, why does the parent warrant such an elevated status in these works? And the answer is not simply by virtue of all of the attributes I have outlined above. The answer is in their status as companion. And once again, history provides valuable insight into the companionship role of the parrot. Too sacred for mere hieroglyphs, the Egyptian parrot was mummified. Yes, a very undignified appearance, but evidence of their importance as cherished pets and accompanying their royal owners into the afterlife. In addition to the honor bestowed upon the parrot in some, not all, cultures, the parrot has a remarkable ability to entertain. In a well-known mosaic from Greek antiquity, now situated in Cologne, a parrot is harnessed to a small toy chariot, centuries before David Letterman's Animal Tricks. As I mentioned in the introduction, the parrot's ability to vocalize is significant. Genre scenes from this period often incorporate the parrot into courtship rituals, such as this later example by de Hoogh. De Hoogh showcases his talent as a master of perspective, a painting influenced by that of Johannes Vermeer's Love Letter from the Rijksmuseum. In both works, the viewer looks through a dark space. Both contain a broom, a chair on the right-hand side, and a curtain pulled back, the last of which is a device used in these dark hikes to accentuate the perspective, and in many ways, the voyeurism, as we witness the distinctly different dramas unfolding. While the broom in both works is a reminder of household duties neglected in their respective interiors, the cittern on the lap of Vermeer's mistress is replaced with a lute resting on the chair of de Hoogh's antechamber. De Hoogh's couple share little in common with Vermeer's mistress and maid, aside from the fact that one figure is standing and the other is seated in both works. Vermeer's figures focus on each other, the letter evidently the cause of the intensity of their exchange. De Hoogh's figures focus on the parrot. The woman gingerly dips a biscuit in a glass of wine in attempt to lure the bird out of the cage, while her companion seems to assist with this effort by holding up the cage door. An unusual offering, admittedly, the bread and wine, but this is no celebration of the Eucharist. On the contrary, this is part of a courtship ritual. Antiquity, again, provides some context here, as it was Aristotle who first advocated this approach to render birds more talkative and amusing, while Pliny the Elder and Apuleius later advocate striking the bird on the head with a rod in order to solicit speech. Fortunately, the Dutch were a bit more civilized. The sexual overtones in this painting are, however, quite clear. The cloaks have been removed and hang in the entrance hall. The lute's ability to make music holds strong sexual connotations, and one might even interpret the room beyond to be more than an artistic attempt to rival Vermeer's ability as perspective painter, but a reference to the culmination of their courtship ritual. In this narrative, the parrot's role in providing helpful narrative clues is twofold. First, the parrot is being coaxed out of his cage, a motif I will discuss in just a bit. Second, and at its most basic level, the parrot is providing entertainment for the flirtatious couple. Entertainment value is of real importance, particularly when it's time for the family portrait and young children are involved. Of course, this family is proud to include their feathered family member, seen here in the center of the composition, but it serves a rather practical purpose. One can almost hear the conversation between the father, the patron who must pay for this commission, and the artist. Let's put Polly front and center. Not only did we pay a fortune for this bird, we'll keep young Wilhelmina occupied. So, returning to this group of works, I think we can safely add the role of companion to the growing list of attributes, and companionship in particular with women. One might be tempted to attribute the female-parrot relationship simply to a man's prerogative. A number of theories, when we take them collectively, successfully decipher the reason for the nearly exclusive appearance of the parrot with a female companion. All of this rhetoric, however, hinges definitively upon the presence or absence of the cage. We have considered the various figures in these three works as Dow's female looks to her right, Netscher looks directly at the viewer, and von Mises looks only at the parrot on the stand. Now consider the parrot's placement in each work. In the painting by von Mises on the far right, the gray parrot is perched on a tiered wooden stand, no cage in sight. I will return to this later, but let us examine the work of Gerrit Dou, who was in fact von Mises' instructor. The young woman removes a blue-fronted Amazon parrot from the dome-topped birdcage she grasps in her other hand. While the parrot may be more than symbol, The addition of the cage as an important symbolic layer of meaning, one which is deeply rooted in history and which I will discuss briefly today. Wealthy Roman citizens living in the early imperial period reportedly housed their parrots in elaborate cages, gilded, sometimes ornamented with jewels, illustrating their pride and ownership of such exotic imports. A fascinating trajectory occurs, however, in which the prosperity of the empire enables so many of its citizens to acquire parrots. These birds become so ubiquitous that they were actually consumed by Roman nobles. Simply put, supply exceeds demand, and parrots disappear into the art and literature of late antiquity, a direct result of this superfluousness. They retreat into relative obscurity in the Middle Ages, with the notable exception of the cage, which is ripe for the pictorial vocabulary of early Christianity, eager to exploit new symbols to distinguish it from its pagan predecessors. Here is where the cage develops an altogether negative connotation. The parrot is represented as animus, the soul. The cage is then the corporal body which confines the human soul. Upon death, the soul is freed from the confines of the cage to ascend into heaven. While early Christian theologians make frequent use of this metaphor, archaeological evidence of this tradition would be nearly impossible were it not for the attention drawn to this iron cage in the church of Santa Giustina in Padua, which was encased within a burial sarcophagus and may contain the skeletal remains of St. Luke the Evangelist. Very exciting find. While the cage is frequently employed, the parrot is not. Its obscurity provokes the imagination of medieval Europe. In the East, Byzantine artisans create elaborate gilded cages with crude mechanical parrots adorning them. In Western Europe, the parrot takes a magical, otherworldly presence, set amidst the dense foliage of the illuminated manuscript, bestiaries, and psalters. The speaking abilities of the parrot become prophetic. Its ethereal presence is embedded in the vellum folio, and the precious inks, often gilded, manifest the parrot with evangelical powers. Logos, the word, is power, and the parrot is vested with the power to impart the word, a sacred message. Its appearance as an actual entity, a pet, or a conspicuous symbol of prosperity, is realized only in the 14th and 15th centuries in inventories and secular commissions, notably illuminated manuscripts and tapestries of wealthy Burgundian dukes. Here, a very poor image, I apologize, of Jean, Duc de Berry. The market demand slowly puts the parrot in a position to soar the trajectory, and the bird is even retitled. The parrot becomes the popinjay. Medieval associations are hard to shake, believe me. I am technically a medievalist reveling in the early modern world of the Dutch. In the Renaissance, however, the parrot becomes exponentially more powerful. It is able to convey logos, the words, powers it was imbued with in the illuminated folios of the medieval Psalter we just saw, but it is now freed from the vellum of the manuscript. It is freed from the confines of the cage and now stands alone in its ability to relay the important New Testament narrative. The parrot is witness, but its beauty, particularly its plumage, do not go unnoticed by the Northern Renaissance painters. The scarlet macaw provides the artistic inspiration for the wings of the Archangel Gabriel in Jan van Eyck's universally loved Annunciation. In the 15th and 16th centuries, the parrot is redefined, perhaps now an amalgam of its medieval, otherworldly attributes, a slight increase in the population of parrots in Europe, which would allow for observation. This is again fused with a patron's interest in incorporating the parrot into these works, perhaps most famously in Jan van Eyck's Madonna with the Canon van der Paal, in which the Indian ringneck parrot is slightly restrained by the Christ child on the lap of the Virgin. In his other hand, and in engraving by Sebastian Beham in the National Gallery's collection, the Virgin herself offers the parrot an apple, which is a clear reference to the original sin necessitating the birth of Christ. By accepting the apple, the parrot may reiterate original sin, for which the Virgin must inevitably make the ultimate sacrifice, her son. Other theories upon the enduring medieval tradition in which the parrot, whose powers of prophecy, made possible through its magical vocalizing abilities, accord the parrot a status which is half divine. Clearly here, as embodied in the carnal creature of the parrot, akin to the dual nature embodied in the Christ child. When appearing in Albrecht Dürer's very well-known Garden of Eden, Fall of Man, its proximity to the placard inscribed with Dürer's name is noteworthy, and even more so in The Fall of Man, later painted by Peter Paul Rubens on the left. In comparison with the strikingly similar composition by Titian, the Italian Baroque painting is absent of one very important figure. Can you find it? The parrot. Yes, it is the scarlet macaw in the tree above, watching the fall from grace unfold before its beady little eyes. Importantly, in Rubens' composition, the parrot is again witness. In reality, I believe it was the Flemish painters of the 17th century, Rubens and Van Dyck in particular, who take the leap, so to speak, and provide the compositional format for the pairing of the bird and the female in a secular context, undoubtedly emboldened by important patrons of the royal and noble variety. Having worked at the court of Charles I, whose avian menagerie would have provided a wonderful opportunity for observation, Rubens accurately renders the blue and gold macaw here on the left. It's indigenous to South America and is featured on the balustrade of this portico, featuring the Madonna and family. Interestingly, a very similar compositional format is adopted to represent figures of nobility, so it becomes a secular grouping, a fine example of which I illustrate here in the National Gallery's own collection. This time, the African gray is featured on the chair of the wife of Sir Balthasar Gerbier. In both paintings, however, the uncaged parrot is placed in proximity to the female, and with the Madonna in the Rubens and the wife of Sir Balthasar Gerbier in the Van Dyck. But it is the latter that we see the parrot in a position of honor among a family, noble, but not sacred. I dove into this deep-rooted pictorial tradition from which parrot and female and parrot and cage derive, not just to inflict medieval torture upon this audience, but to underscore the depth of the historical tradition preceding these works, thus highlighting how innovatively the Dutch reinvented and recast these motifs into a pictorial tradition so effective in conveying the Calvinist ideas, the rhetoric of the newly independent Dutch Republic. But these works were produced for the elite, represent the elite, and would have been viewed exclusively among the elite. But works such as this were not. The emblem book of the 17th century, an example which I illustrate here, was intentionally produced and reproduced for a wider audience and conveyed the ideals and expectations of the Dutch society, stabilized by the moral rectitude of its citizens. Printed illustrations such as these feature subtitles, so to speak, to ensure the moralizing message is understood by all. Jakob Katz, the author of this emblem book, advocates the ideal housewife who readily embraces and enjoys the confine of the cage, her home. The cage has often been understood as a visual metaphor for conjugal felicity, whereas a bird leaving a cage was then seen as a representative of freedom from sexual restraints, a carefully constructed archetype which is then so scandalously splintered by the women depicted in these works. But we must remember, these works were intended for a wealthy, educated elite, likely only seen by a select few. So scandalous is not appropriate, risque, perhaps, but more an opportunity for the Dutch genre painter to do what he did best, provide a bit of drama, select subject matter borderline inappropriate, and definitely antithetical to the moralizing tradition propagated by the emblem books. In an earlier attempt to determine if Dow had painted this bird from life, however, I examined the arrangement of the bird's feet and talon. It's evident that one foot is obscured from view, and the foot in the foreground features only two digits of the talon. Parrot feet are zygodactyl, and therefore feature two digits in front and two digits in the back, as you can see from this illustration in black and white. The blue-fronted Amazon was a popular species and likely one which inhabited the homes of a number of wealthy citizens in the city of Leiden, where Dow, Netscher, and von Mieris worked and produced these paintings in the 1660s. But we can forgive this anatomical inaccuracy upon the discovery of something brilliant. This woman has defied Jakob Katz's prescribed moral code of conduct by removing the parrot from its cage, but she restrains its talon with her thumb and middle finger. So she is tempted by love, yet remains cautious about embracing sexual freedom. What is revolutionary about this work is not the woman contemplating her virginity on the stage like Set. It is Dao's characterization of her uncertainty regarding this decision, wonderfully subtle and articulated discreetly through her interaction with a parrot, Dutch artistic ambiguity at its finest. In the case of Netscher's Young Woman, there is no need to examine the zygodactyl arrangement of the feet. This bird is ready to fly, so to speak. And her suggestive attire and direct engagement with the viewer leave little doubt as to her inclination. Netscher, however, employed this species to good effect. The African gray is the most intelligent of parrots. Its presence is commanding, almost challenging, an appropriate choice to articulate this young woman's disposition. Harvard cognitive behavioral scientist Irene Pepperberg, a personal heroine of mine, who will be at the National Gallery in 2 weeks, spent decades working on an African gray most famously with Alex, whom she purchased from a pet store. Her research hit the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, among many others, and reveals that this species' intelligence, as I mentioned earlier, rivals that of a 5-year-old child. Alex learned to count and add, understanding the numerical concept of zero, identify shapes and colors, and held an extensive vocabulary. Her work stunned, and I mean floored, the scientific community as it established something astonishing. And you see here, also received his own obituary in The Economist. The size of the brain does not correspond to its ability to function. The gray is a brain the size of a walnut. The term bird brain, then, is a complete misnomer. While I doubted my art historical inquiry could have much of an impact upon the woman who changed the field of neuroscience, I did work up the courage to call Dr. Pepperberg to tell her I believe these Dutch paintings could be visual evidence of a society, perhaps the first, who not only recognized the cognitive abilities of the first, but documented this in paintings of the highest caliber, fetching vast sums of money on the market and providing an elite clientele with exactly what they wanted, a reflection of their own society's sophistication, ideals, and erudition, through which this parrot may evidence an early understanding of the cognitive abilities of the African gray. While the ability of these species, as well as others, has been broadly understood as mimicry, the recognition of its cognitive abilities does indeed have historical precedent. Sharing this brief anecdote from the 16th century zoological treatise by Conrad Gesner, it is again not solely for amusement, but to provide evidence of a historical tradition in which the parrot was viewed as more than symbol, and importantly, more than mimicry. Henry VIII is among the list of notable figures in history to own a parrot, specifically an African gray. There exists no painted record of this, so I took some license here. Housed at Hampton Court, probably in the privy chamber of the 16th century residence, it would have been suspended from a cage with a magnificent view of the River Thames. Perched imperiously from this vantage point, the parrot would call to the ferryman on the opposite banks of the River Thames, a boat for £20. This is sheer entertainment for the bird, as ferrymen would scramble to their boats, race one another against the Thames to find, of course, no customer. This cunning creature delighted himself in trickery, illustrating not only his intelligence, but cognitive abilities. Cause and effect and its application, often humorous and entertaining, is so much more than mimicry. Could the advanced cognitive abilities of the gray parrot have been not only recognized by the Dutch a century later, but put into the practice of education? Certain visual clues in this painting by Jan Steen indicate the woman is ambitious in her pursuit of education. Parrots do not like the taste or smell of wine, so she includes the biscuit, as we've seen in a number of paintings from this period. The mother coaxes the parrot to the door of the cage and indulges him with a head scratch, the ultimate bribe, and an indication that she is the owner. Only an owner would be granted such trust as he bows down his head and allows her such intimacy. The maidservant, mother, and child form a distinct triangular grouping with the parrot at its apex. The goal is not merely entertainment, it is instruction, a lesson in language, Consider the model rival technique used by cognitive neuroscientists today. That is, in an attempt to encourage one to participate, just as the parrots in Dr. Pepperberg's lab, they essentially play one subject off the other and motivate them to speak in a spirit of competition. Whether such advanced neuroscientific practices were practiced by the Dutch, I cannot say with certainty. But I can say that work such as The Woman Feeding a Parrot by Frans van Mieris indicates a tremendous sensitivity and awareness of the parrot's behavior. In my mind, the most accurate depiction of the species in the history of art, and likely due to the fact Painter owned such a parrot. I have yet to find an inventory of this household or a reference to this effect, but I am convinced by the manner in which van Mieris infuses this scene with tenderness, psychology, and even humor. Showcasing his talent as a Feenschilder painter, he patiently observes and sensitively renders these figures in layer upon layer of paint, revealing their emotions as well as his own. His wife, Kunera, to whom he likely gifted this parrot, is oblivious to the viewer, and by extension, to her husband behind the easel. The parrot shows little interest in the treat she offers him, nor does he care that she is working, indicated by the thimble on her finger. In fact, the thimble intrigues this parrot, indicating it is a foreign object worn by the hand of the woman who has the exclusive privilege to handle him. These creatures are highly monogamous and highly observant. A change in nail polish will incite tremendous curiosity from my own parrot. With gloves, it's Panic City. The parrot's head is bowed and slightly arced, and the feathers at the crest of his neck are just about to rise in supplication for her to stroke. He pleads with the pinning of his eyes for her to release the other hand, the one without the thimble, which is curled against the ermine fur of her beautiful mantle and holding the linen strewn across her lap. Her thoughtful expression indicates she will acquiesce, put aside her task, and indulge her beloved pet with the attention he seeks. While similar compositions extol the virtues of the docile, diligent housewife focused intently on her needlework, van Mieris celebrates humanity and the distractions from routine, part of the universal appeal of this painting, I believe. I hope you have illustrated today that the parrot's value as companion, with the ability to entertain, reason, and integrate itself into the family, ascribes to them more than value as commodity, more than mere symbol. If you have seen the exhibition, you have undoubtedly been rewarded with not only a dazzling array of paintings depicting a most elegant society engaged in various pursuits. These pursuits are articulated in a similar yet distinctly different manner. Words such as imitation and sometimes motif undermine effort and extinguish the possibility of new discoveries. So if we relegate the parrot, featured in so many works of this genre, to mere symbol, we miss the opportunity to examine a unique creature, one with extraordinary talent and intelligence, a creature with an ability to observe, learn, experiment, respond, and engage human interest, to exhibit loyalty and affection, and merit their painted presence not only as beautiful symbols of prosperity and sophistication, but as beloved members of the family. If we dismiss these factors and consider the parrot's presence as a motif in a strictly emulative curriculum and a narrowly conceived iconographic repertoire, then one of the most innovative periods in the history of art is shortchanged. If we see the parrot as symbol, we marginalize the innate, authentic response of this society to express love, loyalty, and interaction among themselves, which is both intensely personal and universal, but distinctly Dutch. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.